Hello, you are listening to the Plumfield Moms, and this is Our Reading Life in partnership with our friends from BiblioGuides.
Hi, I'm Diane Pendergraft, and I'm here with Sarah Masaryk, and we have Sarah Kim and Tanya Arnold with us today for Our Reading Life, and it seems like it's been a really long time.
I know. I was just going to say that, Diane, that when Sarah and Tanya were coming in, I was like, hey, girls, haven't seen you in a while. And I missed you. I missed this. Our recording schedule's out of whack. And so it's been many weeks since we've had a chance to talk like this. So welcome to Our Reading Life, strangers. Good to see you.
Well, and don't you think it's funny? I think we go through seasons where we actually talk every day. And then sometimes it's like we're putting our heads down, putting our shoulders to the wheel, and we're just working and there's no conversation. It's just everyone's working. And then we bring up our heads up for air. Hey, how are you? Yeah. And it's Ben.
But some of us
not
bring
Dad.
Our thumbs up. Is Tanya okay, do you think?
I know. Because people are used to me being a lot more chatty in various conversations, and I've just had my head down plugging along.
Well, I think it's life in general, but I also think that it's amplified because when the four of us get together, there ends up being a lot of creative energy, and the more time we spend together, the bigger our to-do list gets. So sometimes we have to just ignore each other so we can go do the things on the list.
No, you can't just be in list creation all the time. You have to be in list
exactly.
Crossing
just
off
the magnificent idea machine into neutral for a while.
Right?
Well, goodness. Friends, today Diane and I wanted to start because we're actually reading a couple of things together, which is not a normal thing for us. In 10 years of being friends, Diane, our reading has overlapped. Hardly ever.
Right. I don't even know.
Yeah. Even when we've tried, when we've said, you read this and I'll read this. And then one of us goes, kind of peters out on it. Or something more important comes along. Or we read it, but we don't have the chance to talk about it. Mm-hmm. But something's really different for us in this time around. Sarah and Tanya, when we talked with Sherry and Christy a couple of months ago, we talked about having a word of the year. And for me, that also, like, other things come alongside that. But do you girls have a word of the year? Do you guys do that? And if so, do you have one?
I don't usually do that. But this year, I did have a word in my head. It's not like an official thing I've actually even written down. But the word is strength.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Partly for my body, because I feel like over the last 2 years of being pregnant and postpartum and not getting nearly as much activity as I normally would, I've like lost muscle mass. So it's partly that. It's also just, and other things, other aspects of my life too, I feel like just being stronger would be really
good. And maybe also that you are strong. Like, I think sometimes the word, at least in my experience, the word can mean many things, like all versions of the word. So it can mean strength to gain strength, to regain strength. Can also mean that you are strong, you have strength, and that might be tested or exercised a little.
Especially if you have a word like that and you think you know what it means, you might as well just be sure that God's going to show you what he meant by it.
Right. I also have a Bible verse that has just stayed with me for many, many years, that I can do all things through him who strengthens me. So that also, I think, is part of it.
Yeah, right? For sure. Yeah. That's really exciting. Have you seen this word show up in your reading or other things? Is it sort of being confirmed for you? Okay.
Not yet.
I mean, the year's early.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, we'll be excited to hear, you know, how that plays out. And if it starts showing up in your reading, that might be really fun to see.
Yeah, I will watch for it more closely.
Tanya, what about you? Do you do the word of the year thing?
Nope. I'm just one of those weirdos. But
no, I never did
get
either.
On board, I guess.
I don't.
Yeah.
I don't know. I love the idea. I've seen people talk about it and it crosses my mind, but it's not anything that resonates with me really powerfully. I can see it show up powerfully for other people, but nope.
I love it. No, that's great.
Yeah. And it's not that I don't have a goal or a focus or things that are impressed upon my heart that I'm thinking about. It usually isn't tied to the year. It's usually just tied to the season that I'm in and how I'm trying to connect with God about whatever is weighing on my mind or direction I feel like I might need to have. And so that it can just be a shifting. I mean, I do have goals and thoughts and impressions, right? It's just a shifting sort of thing that's not really tied to the beginning of the year.
So Diane, what about you? Remind our listeners, in case they didn't hear that episode with the librarians, what is your word
of
the year?
Well, I don't usually do one either, and I don't do it officially like praying for one or anything like that. But while we were talking about it, I just thought, you know, maybe education. And that means a lot of things to me too, because part of it is just like here with what I'm trying to do with the library and other things is people don't know what I'm trying to do. So I can't expect them to join me when they have no idea.
Right. Education, awareness, all of that. Lovely. Well, the reason I bring it up is because Diane and I are reading some of the same stuff right now, because my word of the year is so often tied with some kind of spiritual principle or something. And I don't always know how they're connected at the beginning of the year, but by the end of the year, I'm like, oh, okay, I see how that played out. So my word of the year this year is message. And the reason why I ask this question is because so often I find my word in what we're reading, or I hear it confirmed in what I'm reading. But also there's very often it's connected to or tied to specific things that I'm supposed to read or spiritual principles that I'm supposed to be studying. And so this year I felt with the word message, I also felt a very strong pull to spend some focused time in the Pauline letters of the New Testament. So right now I'm in Romans and just doing a very slow, careful read of Romans, journaling through it, etc. And my spiritual director had recommended to me today when I met with him, he said, one of the things I'm hearing you say is that your word message is singular, not plural, like messages. And he said, so I think that might be something to pray about, is how is it one message? Obviously, when I think of the word message, I think of the message of the gospel. I think of the message of Jesus Christ. But he said it can also mean when we're looking at our vocations and all of the things that we're trying to do, what is the message that we are communicating to the world? And with all the things that we do, I have a lot of focus. I have a lot of divided focus. So how can I bring that focus singularly back into one message? So I thought that's a very interesting way to start my year. But one of the things that I realized is that if I'm going to read the Pauline letters, one of the things I'd really like to do is read a biography on St. Paul or something, you know, kind of that ilk. I have always loved Peter best. And so, you know, Peter and Paul and the tension between the two of them, it feels very weird to me to be spending a year with Paul, but that's what I'm doing. And so I reached for a book called The Glorious Folly by Louis Duval, which listeners of this podcast might remember that last summer I was reading a book called The Spear by Louis Duval. This is the sequel to that book. And it is about Cassius Longinus, who was the centurion who pierced the side of Christ. But it's about Paul being received into the church after his conversion, and Cassius being one of the players in the church, because now he's one of the converted Christians. And so, interestingly, Diane said, well, I'm going to read St. Paul this year as well. And so Diane is reading a different book about Paul. And it's been fun because we're both reading along and I'm like, well, this is what's going on in my book. And she's like, oh gosh, he's still a teenager in my book. And we've been having a lot of fun going back and forth. So Diane, what are you reading?
It's called The Great Lion of God by Taylor Caldwell. And I am 54% through, and Jesus just died. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. I'm only 30% into The Glorious Folly, and it's already Paul and Barnabas on the road together. Clearly different focus in these two books.
He was a very troubled and angsty teenager, and very so serious about God that he didn't like to have any fun. Or he made one mistake in his life, a huge sin that he committed that he just couldn't get past, and and his dad was, his mom died young, and then his dad was depressed, and then his dad killed himself, and then, but nobody wanted to tell Paul. Paul was in Jerusalem when this happened. His dad was home in Tarsus, and he killed himself out of despair, and can't tell Paul because that's shameful, and it's not terrible, but I'm tired.
How much of that do you think is based on things that are actually known about Paul?
I don't know of any of it actually being known. I think a lot of it's just like, how can we fill in the gaps in his life knowing that, or thinking that we know that he never married, or, and a lot of people feeling like he hated women, you know, how did that happen?
Oh.
And how he was so earnestly a Pharisee when he was young, how did that happen? And I think she was just trying to make it plausible that he was, she's trying to build him into the person that people think he was.
Interesting.
And make it dramatic.
Interesting. Because so we're, the one that I'm reading, it is about his ministry, and it's about, mm-hmm. I mean, it's truly incredible the humility that he had, you know, after his conversion, he goes into the desert for 3 years to be refined and to learn how to hear the Lord clearly without distraction. And so my book opens with the stoning of Stephen, but it opens right before the stoning of Stephen, when Paul interviews Stephen, and Paul and Stephen have this theological debate back and forth, and it pricks his conscience. And it's such an interesting way to go into these, to go into this story, and then follow. It's all being told kind of through the point of view of Cassius Longinus, who distrusts Paul. You know, he thinks Saul is very, very dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
And then, but then what's interesting is Cassius is married to a Jewish woman. And so their child is half Roman, half Jewish, but she's a Christian. And there was this beautiful line in the passage I read the other day about how this little girl has a fondness in her heart for Saul that like nobody else has. And Saul loves this little girl. And Cassius says to Barnabas, I think, I wonder if it's because in her is the tension realized between the Jews and the Gentiles, that the Jews and the Gentiles will come together into Christianity. And so it's just a very neat, cool, artistic way of playing with that idea. So I'm only about a third of the way through my book because I'm reading it slowly, but I like mine better than yours.
I think I do too. I haven't even read it. But I read this book about 40 years ago, and I read a few of hers, I think. There's one called The Dear and Glorious Physician that was about Luke, and I remember really liking that one.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember really liking this one, but now I'm reading it going, oh, please, pages of them, someone talking about the evils of the Roman Empire and their taxation and how it makes people do bad things, and how the bread in circuses was bad for the empire, and it's going downhill, and we know which, you know, it's going to have to fall, and lots of description.
Mm.
And so I know we've talked about how, like in Ben-Hur, the description is there because people needed
it. Right.
But she wrote this in 1970. I don't really need a description of everybody's courtyard separately. I get the idea. How many fountains does one person need?
Well, and so I think that brings us to an interesting segue into the other thing we wanted to talk about. So your book was written in the 1970s. I think mine was written in the 50s or the 60s. For the record, friends, I'm terribly sorry. It's wickedly expensive. It's out of print. And even though Ignatius Press reprinted many of his others, this one, they do not have the rights to. I actually reached out to them and asked them why they had not printed this one. And they said it was a rights issue. And I speculate, I have nothing to merit this on, I speculate that because it would have been coming out at a time when movies like Ben-Hur and The Robe were so popular, I speculate that they, that somebody in Hollywood bought the script, bought it to turn it into a script, and then it just never got made. And so it's probably, we're just never going to see it for a long time because they would have locked down those rights for, you know, like 100 years or whatever. So, so that said, it's interesting. These are both 20th century books, and we're reading them at the same time that we're reading Ben-Hur. Ben-Hur is not a 20th century book. And what's interesting is the liberties that she's taking with Paul in your book, that Caldwell is taking with Paul in your book, and some of the liberties that they're taking with mine. These are about actual scriptural characters, building vibrant lives around them. And one of the things that you and I have always noted about Ben-Hur is how hands-off Lew Wallace is with the actual details of Christ's life. Like, the details are the details, and we're not messing with them. We're not adding to them one iota. We're not adding one syllable to his mouth, nothing. How different these two stories, these two kinds of stories are.
But she has had Paul run into Jesus in various situations, I think three different times, and just like coming face to face with him and being struck by him and the feeling drawn to him and then fighting that feeling.
Ah, interesting.
Because he knows this guy is nobody.
Right.
And then he actually, he sees Jesus in one thing. He goes around, a whole bunch of Galileans are being crucified for being rebellious.
Right.
And Jesus goes around and comforts them. Mm-hmm. And Paul watches this and he's very much affected by that. And then because of that, gets sick and has a fever and it ruins one of his eyes. And so, you know, here's how he became whatever his thorn in the flesh.
Yeah.
That's what it is. This eye injury from his fever that he had. And while he had the fever, he was having dreams about this situation where Jesus was comforting the people on the cross. And there's just a lot of odd spiritual things like that. He's very good friends with Joseph of Arimathea, who also has visions and has told Paul, you know, God's got something in mind for you.
Interesting.
Because he's had visions about Paul. So some of it's just kind of like, I don't understand why that was necessary. Just build the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's the way she chose to go with it. So there's all these little connections of everybody's having dreams about stuff, and Paul keeps running into Jesus. Now he's back in Tarsus because his dad died, and on the way home, he ran into Luke on the boat.
Oh, interesting.
So
interesting.
Yeah. I don't remember any of that from 40 years ago. I think I was just reading it as a novel and not very discriminating and just going, hey, this is a cool story. And now I'm crabbier about it.
I would be too, though.
Yeah.
Especially after we did a little looking and I'm like, I'm not really sure that she's all that trustworthy as an author. She's got some weird theology going on there.
Yeah. But I'm going to finish it so that I can know and
give, you know, all of us the warning to not have to read it, right?
Right. Yes, I'm reading this for you.
I don't mind biblical stories that have some conjecture. I actually like it, right? Like, I like The Chosen. It's a story in a different format. Love The Chosen. And I think at some level there is some conjecture that has to happen. Yeah, to bring the story to life and to maybe – but usually it's a good educated guess, right? Using – all of these sources, here's something that would be very plausible. And I think that's okay to do. And I actually really appreciate that because, again, it brings the story to life and helps you feel something in a different way. It's just when the conjecture goes a little too far, maybe. And that's where it gets this gray area, right?
And a lot – or with a lot of modern prejudice towards it. Like,
yeah,
things that they would never have valued back then, but we're ascribing them to them now because we care about those things.
Yeah. So like with Taylor Caldwell, I mean, I'm just wondering, I don't mind saying that Paul met Luke at this particular juncture, right?
Right.
Maybe Luke was traveling on this boat. We know it. And maybe we know that Paul was in the area and this could have been plausible.
No, because we don't know how they met.
Right.
Right. So I think, okay, so there is something that potentially could have happened, but we don't know.
Right.
I think when you start having it be like the people are having dreams about specific people with spiritual connections, that isn't
it gets
stated.
Muddy.
Yeah. Then it gets really muddy.
Yeah.
That's where I start to scratch my head and go, I don't know. I don't know about that when it comes to these biblical stories.
That's the thing, is that as I read it, I'm going, what was that for? I don't think it added. But that's one thing about, like, the story of Ben-Hur, all conjecture. But that's okay, because hundreds of thousands of people came in contact with Jesus, and we don't have their stories.
And Wallace did years worth of research on the people and the place. So the story he's writing about those hundreds of thousands of people who came in contact with Christ, this is a completely plausible story. It's set so accurately in the time and the place. It's consistent with the way the people thought.
And Ben-Hur does come in contact with Jesus. Yeah. That's what the story's about. But he doesn't like become some intimate friend that just happened to not get mentioned in the Gospels or something. No. He just contacts him and becomes a convert.
But that's also a fictional character.
Right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or Joseph of Arimathea.
Right.
Or Joseph of Arimathea, right? So then you think, well,
Yes, you do. Which is a very deep philosophical and literary contemplation.
It is. Isn't it?
It covers a multitude of questions and sins, does it not?
I actually think it's one of the best answers. It's because having an answer always ready, as if you already know or have an opinion. I think sometimes my best answer usually is,
Let me ponder that.
Absolutely.
Now, see, I think The Glorious Folly I would hands down recommend. At least so far. If it continues in the same vein that it's headed in, and if it continues as like the Spear did, The Glorious Folly to me does not seem to mar my understanding of any of these characters of the Gospels at all. It seems to just enliven them. Like he describes the first meeting between Paul and Peter when Peter is trying to ascertain whether or not this is a trap. And whether or not Paul is actually trying to get Peter to say or do something that would incriminate himself. Now, he wisely doesn't break that conversation down. He sets up the beginning. He lets Paul have his testimony. Then there's some unspoken things that happen. And then Peter admits that he sees a light in Paul, which could only be there if the Holy Spirit had put it there. And he leaves it to the Holy Spirit to fill in the details. I like that a lot.
One of the other things about this one is that I couldn't recommend it for anybody but adults. And there's just a few things, but there's enough that I couldn't say, yes, your teenager should read this book. Because he has an encounter with a slave girl, which is one that the sin that he can't forgive himself for. And then just got to the part where he comes back to Tarsus and realizes he's seeing his son.
Oh, like Augustine.
What?
But the son doesn't know that he thinks someone else is his father. And so there's that whole thing that, again, what was that for?
Yeah, I just, one word.
Yeah. So there are just enough of that kind of thing that I wouldn't recommend this for just anyone.
And I will have to put the same disclaimer. While I've had no experience so far in The Glorious Folly that's like that, in The Spear there is one scene. And it is, it's the undoing of characters. And it's handled as tastefully as it can be handled, but it's there. And so we're remembering it throughout. Even in this book, I remember that scene. And so I would say this one too, I would be cautious about, or at least pre-read.
Interesting.
So Paul, the Pharisee, but so the other thing, as we've teased, is that Diane and I are reading Ben-Hur. She's reading it with her class, and I'm reading it both with my Tuesday night book club and with a group of teenagers and their parents. We have I'm doing it at the same time in two book clubs. I'm doing it with two book clubs at the same time. And I know you ladies have not read Ben-Hur yet. For Diane and I, we've read it many times. And we're working on a book club guide for it because it's one of our favorites. And I don't know about you, Diane, but I just feel like I'm coming home every time I read it.
It's been different every time. It was interesting with this group, but I am done. I insisted that we finish before I had to be gone for a month. So because the kids, I don't think they would have carried everything over and, you know, just been happy, so happy and excited for me to be back so they could go back to it.
Well, how was it different for you this time?
Just a different group of kids. The last time I did it with teenagers, it was four readerly girls. And this time it's a really varied group of about a dozen with boys and girls and ages 12 to 17. And so just a lot more observations and discussion because they're seeing it from all different perspectives.
Interesting. You know, I always just think of it as like a great romantic novel that happens to have really profound truth in it. And at our Tuesday night book club, some of the teenagers were hanging out, not for our book club, but they were there and they were hanging out downstairs while we were upstairs discussing. And I went down and I asked a couple of the teenagers, do you want to join us? Because you guys missed the other discussion. Do you want to join? They're like, no, we're actually a little behind in the reading. And, the collective answer is the wise men are weird. Right? Like everybody thinks the wise men are weird. And it was fun to hear my son, my 16-year-old, say to them, yeah. He's like, just get through the wise men. Just get through that part. And then it becomes a proper Roman novel. And all the boys in the room were like, oh, yeah. Okay. That's great to know. And I'm like, a proper Roman novel? Like, what is that? But these are the kids that debate Roman history together and military history. And they think of it as sort of like a soldier's text, like a text that a soldier would read and enjoy in the proper Roman way, whatever that means.
I guess that was different, too, is that this whole group of kids, out of all of them, none of them said, why are we reading this weird thing? When we started out with that first part, they just did it. And we're going, okay. Yeah. And we did that all in one week and came back and talked about it. And nobody said, what in the world is going on here? They just took it as... probably. Oh, here's another weird thing Mrs. Pendergraft is making us read. But they didn't complain about it. Can't be worse than Shakespeare.
Awesome. Well, out of curiosity, do you both generally read biblical fiction? I'm just sitting here thinking, I haven't read Ben-Hur. It's been on my to-read list for a million years. And I've not read either of the two books about Paul. I'm familiar with Taylor Caldwell, and I'm familiar with this other author because you talked about the spear. And I'm thinking, well, what biblical fiction have I read? Do I read biblical fiction? And I can only think of three off the top of my head. One is for children, and I'm going to have to look it up. I can't remember, but it's about a boy who's Roman or English. Anyway, he gets taken as a slave, and then his master, who's Roman, takes him to Judea.
Oh, and the book is called Judea, isn't it?
No.
Slave Boy in Judea or something, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, Slave Boy in Judea.
Yes,
yeah.
And I really enjoyed that. So that's a children's story. But then other than that, I've only read The Robe, which I do love.
Ugh. I know, I do not.
Really?
I know.
And The Red Tent. Which I hate.
I started that and did not read it. I thought, I am not going to like where this is going.
Read it twice because I liked it the first time. And then the second time I went, what was I thinking? This is nonsense.
Yeah, I read it one time. But again, it was my early 20s.
Me too.
And I was just angry. I was just angry about it. I did not like it. Interesting about The Robe. You and I will have to have another discussion about that because I loved it. But again, it's been like 25 years since I read
it. Okay, so if you loved it, you will love Ben-Hur. Because they feel very, very similar. I think Douglas did that on purpose. I think he was mimicking Ben-Hur. But the theology is really weird. So it goes very new.
Oh, I did think there was some interesting ideas. But it was more, for me, I just let that go. And I was just more drawn to the idea of this Roman
being
man.
Converted. That
Yeah, speculating about what did happen to that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just was fascinated with like the way the journey and his story was told and his heart being opened to Jesus being the Christ. I just was.
Yes.
I that's what I loved. There was some weird things for sure that I just thought, well, you know, I can set that to the wayside for this this other piece that is this really great story.
Well, but see, this is where, and this is was what Lew Wallace was working really, really hard to not screw up in Ben-Hur, is that we have to be so careful, because when we read biblical fiction, we begin to conflate our thinking with that of what we've taken in. And if there's weird theology in there that could lead us astray, we might have some disordered ideas then. Like, I remember, like, in the Red Tent, you could end up with some really disordered ideas about what it was to be a Jewish woman. Like, I won't get into the details because my own kids are editing this podcast. But the scenes with the guys out by the trees, it's just, I can't not unthink that now. And I'm not saying that the historical value of it isn't real, but that's not what the takeaway of the scripture is. And so that's where we have to be so careful. And that's where, like, the Taylor Caldwell book to me makes me go, what? And the robe, I'm like, golly, it was so attractive and lovely and such a beautiful thought experiment until it was like a somebody heaped a bunch of arsenic into the cereal.
That's another one. I think I probably read it about the same time. So it's been 40 years and I don't even remember that. I remember being thinking the story was pretty good, but then I saw the movie and I was just mad. But I think to answer Tanya's question, I don't go looking for biblical fiction. And part of it is just, there's so much of it that is garbage. Taylor Caldwell has one called I, Judas, and it starts out as a first person account of Judas's life. And I'm just sitting there going, I'm not going to have sympathy for this guy. Don't even try. I don't want to hear about how emotionally scarred he is or whatever. There's no excuse for this. Don't even try. I'm not going to read 300 or 400 pages about, oh, poor me.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. Interesting. Well, what about you ladies? What have you girls been reading?
Well, I would love to say that I've been reading something really fun, but I...
but not. So everybody, prepare yourself. What Tanya's about to say is not fun.
Not fun. Oh, my goodness. I was thinking back, trying to remember books that I've talked about so far, and I feel like I keep bringing these educational books and these mom culture books.
Gee, is there something going on in your life, Tanya?
Right? And I know that all of us are reading those types of books. It just seems to be that this is kind of prevalent for me right now. Mm-hmm. And so I was sharing with you all that my 9-year-old is just in a stage where I was not feeling that we were being successful schooling together. Mm. And partly is just because of the nature of who she is. She is not thriving with me. I had this vision and it was a Jesse Wilcox Smith painting.
Oh yeah.
And the dog was sleeping by the fire and I'm reading out loud to her and she's looking at me with rapt attention. And it was this beautiful, it's just beautiful all the time.
Right.
And she is not really excited about any of my ideas. And I am good at handling hard situations and conflict, but I don't choose to put myself in the daily grind, right? I'm not interested in doing that. I'm always like, okay, well, what would be another solution? What would be another option where we both can thrive? Mm-hmm. Because I view this as we're working together towards what's good for our family, what's good for you, not us in opposition. Right. And I guess I was finding us in opposition and I just can't operate like that. So essentially the path I've been led down is essentially creating like a little school that now operates out of my home with, you know, 20 kids coming a couple times a week, all day long.
It started as like a 2-hour thing once a week.
It started as a nature journaling thing and then add addition of a book club. And the next thing I know is it's a 10 to 4 twice a week, 3 days a week pretty soon, school. So I've been reading a lot and you guys know I love to thrift. And for about 4 to 6 weeks, I was going to a particular thrift store and there was this book called Helping Children Write that was published in 1949. Ooh. And multiple times I picked it up and said, oh, I don't want to read that. And then I put it back on the shelf and left it there. And each week I came back And that book was still sitting there. And I kept telling myself, well, if it's still here the next week, then maybe I'll pick it up. And finally, somewhere between the fourth and sixth week, I just said, fine. fine. You shall come home with me. And I think this is just another one of those things where God was telling me, you have some learning to do. Mm-hmm. And this is the beginning of it. And I know I've read a lot about narration and the importance of narration and that leading to written narration, but I still have a lot of questions about writing in general. Mm-hmm. And the woman that wrote this book, and I just want to share a few things because it has been such food for thought and it ties in to reading so much that I can't stop thinking about it. So it's called Helping Children Write, A Thinking Together About Children's Creative Writing by Mari Applegate. Rural Department State Teachers College in La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Ah!
So she's a teacher and she's writing this for elementary teachers. Mm-hmm. But I think it's so applicable to homeschooling moms. And so the very first chapter is called Treasures. And it starts with a poem and it says, little boys' pockets hold amazing things. Fishworms, apple cores, a mess of strings. But this treasure is nothing to the wealth one finds in little boys' hearts and in little boys' Aww. Minds. And I was like, oh my goodness. It's so plum-filled. So her idea here is what are we really trying to do with writing? And what really is the purpose? And how do we really bring that out in children? Mm-hmm. And so I just want to quote a couple of things and we can maybe talk about it. And it starts with the essence of what a child is and who a child is. So she says, to help children, we must know children. It is hard to understand people who play act much of the time. Children have learned that it is usually wiser not to be themselves before adults. They have tried it too many times with disappointment. Mm. A child will no sooner turn out the pockets of his mind to one he does not trust than a shy little boy will turn out the treasures of his trousers pocket to a stranger. He has so many wonderings, questions, fears, and dreams, and so few adult friends with whom he can share them. Mm. And then she goes on and says, writing starts from ideas, and children are full of ideas.
Yes, they are.
Creative ideas are those we believe in so strongly that they pound on the inner door to be released. It does not matter whether a teacher assigned the writing or we assigned it to ourselves. If we feel it, we can be taught to write it. Writing without feeling is anemic and bloodless, and the writer has no pride in it. Creative writing, then, is writing that pushes itself out of a bed of ideas. It may not be particularly original. So what does creative writing do for boys and girls other than to help them to express themselves better? And goodness knows they need that. For one thing, it provides them with chimneys. Look around you at the happiest folks. They are those who have discovered chimneys to release their inner steam and pressure.
Oh,
do you love that?
I love that.
I was like, I love that it's the goal of writing would be to create happiness and joy, mm-hmm. that there's these inner feelings and that when we learn to express them, mm-hmm. that it brings forth joy.
Right.
And then she says it also gives children something to be proud of, and that this pride is the starch which puts a bit of stiffening into limp folks whom the washing machine of life has subjected to rough treatment. A teacher who judges the efficacy of creative writing by what it has done to the writer will use entirely different standards for judging the writing than will the teacher who is engrossed with the writing as an end in itself.
Right. Right.
I was like, wow. Mm. And then this is what she said. Teachers of creative writing are more interested in what writing does for children than in what the children write. They are more interested in individual growth than in comparative products. If the end product is the goal of writing, pattern work will produce a better product, but it will not change children. The pattern teacher spends her time tying leaves on dead trees.
Oh.
The teacher of creative
Right? Tying leaves on dead trees. That's Hercules Beale
yep.
painting the tree red.
Yes. The teacher of creative writing creates a climate where leaves can grow naturally. Mm. Your job is to get children to want to grow in their literary tastes. And it is necessary for you to furnish experiences which will allow for that growth. Mm. So this is what she says that both the teacher and the children must do. And this is just chapter one. She says, this is so much. Read a little every day from a really good book. Read prose and poetry aloud to yourself until the beauty of the spoken word casts its spell upon you. Read aloud to your children. Choose books a level or two above what children can read for themselves. Mm-hmm. Don't make the mistake of talking much about the book. Great stories need no artificial respiration to make them alive to others. They need merely to be read, first together, later alone. From reading to writing is a natural step. Reading and writing have always lived next door to each other, but few people have found the hole in the hedge between them. It is through wide reading that one learns to write, and it is through writing that one learns the fine points of reading. Can you teach children to write creatively? Only the pattern teacher is foolish enough to think that she can. But you can help children to release the creativity within them that seeks expression. If you prove yourself a friend to children and they find you worthy, they will share with you the treasures of their hearts.
Mm. Bravo.
You die. Yeah. I know, right? I was like, that's so inspiring. Yeah. And so her whole premise of this book is how to bring forth that creativity in this really natural, beautiful way that's basically like unlocking the ideas that's inside them. And the first premise is poetry.
Yeah.
All she does is poetry and helping them do small rhymes and having the teacher share poetry nonstop. And then further chapters go on to tell tales. And then she shares excerpts out of the book of various children that have written things. And she says at the very beginning, these aren't gifted children. Mm-hmm. These are your average children. But inside, we can unlock their creativity and the ideas of their experiences. And here's how we do it. And it's tied to what we read to them,
yeah,
and what we provide to them. Right. And I just, again, it's like brilliant and beautiful, but also I think we keep wanting these formulas. Education keeps being this, if you do this and if you write this certain way, then you're going to get this certain result. Mm-hmm. And she's saying, you can't, it cannot be done that way. It's almost mad, like magic. It has to be looking at the child, I think as Charlotte Mason said, as a whole person. Mm-hmm. And providing them with this rich content and then allowing these opportunities for these ideas to come forth. Because I keep thinking, what should I do with writing for Ava besides like narration? How do I help her tell stories? Mm-hmm. Anyway.
I love that.
Any thoughts? Because these are my ideas. I'm just like, this book is so beautiful. And I love how she said there's this hedge between writing and reading, and most people can't get to this hedge. And the one informs the other. And then as you become a better writer, it will inform you to be a better reader.
Exactly.
I love that.
So my kids, because I'm a book reviewer, my two little kids, not my bigger kid, my two little kids have really taken to doing a pretty decent job of writing thoughtful book reviews. You know, they've imitated that. Diane can speak to whether or not, well, this is like what she's saying, right? Like, we're not trying to fulfill the pattern. So Diane always reads their stuff and gives feedback. And it was pretty hilarious when finally she said, Jack, okay, it's because I care about you and I think you're going to be a really great writer. We need to have a conversation about a couple of things. You're just being lazy. Because he was totally being lazy. And then she also said, Jack, you need to start looking words up. Because you need to learn how to spell. So now every time we see a dictionary, we take a picture and send it to Diane. Look, Jack has another new dictionary because he needs to look words up.
Well, it's interesting because there's two aspects, mm-hmm. right? There's first the ideas that need to be told, and then there's the technical part of how do you then tell a story.
Correct.
Sometimes we aren't helping a child develop their ideas into a written way. And we focus so much on the technical before we've even helped the idea to form. To form expression. Or maybe we focus so much on the form and the ideas, but we've never then at the right stage adapted the technical aspect. And for a lot of homeschool moms, I think figuring out how to bridge this gap and like how to help ideas come forth. And know when should I have let my children write or what kinds of things can I do? And in this book are a lot of little ideas of almost like activities and game type things And I'm going to actually develop a little program myself. I'm in the middle of it, called Play with Words, meaning just to help children start playing with ideas and playing with words and expressing those and then building upon that. And she just does a great job of providing a lot of really good ideas that you could do in a group format or a group setting to help children express themselves without there being like, it's time to write a book report. Right.
Or there's a test after this.
Sounds very fun. And it kind of goes along really nicely with narration because narration is so open-ended, right? Like you don't expect a particular answer from your child. You want what is in their heart to come out that they took from whatever it is that they're reading or looking at or observing. And you give them kind of a blank page in many cases, or it's not like a workbook or a answer these questions. It sounds very compatible. And it would be fun to have ideas to help them then know, okay, this would be a great way to express what I'm thinking.
Yeah, that's how I was feeling, Sarah, is I felt like this was very compatible and it could go in conjunction with narration. But yeah, it was giving some practical ideas and maybe some ways to maybe make that more interesting for children. A different way to approach something in a narration, or a different way to express an idea or to think about an idea. And a lot of it has to do with the teacher modeling as well. So one of her quotes is, you as a teacher, and this would be us as mothers, we need to fall in love with reading. We need to fall in love with poetry. We need to have it become part of our vernacular and the way we express ourselves, so that we're sharing our stories, we're sharing our ideas, and that and Sarah Mazarek, you were saying that the more you write reviews, the more your children, no one's assigned them to write reviews necessarily, but they do want to model. They're like, I want to try that. I want to share my thoughts. And it's such an organic, inspiring type of motivation for the children, rather than this requirement of, I'm now being required. You know, like, I know a lot of Charlotte Mason moms say, my kids hate narration. And then I think, okay, well, then we have to change something.
I think there's a lot that would say they don't like narration, but then they come to value it as they get older and they realize why it was so important that they do it. They see.
Yeah.
It's like everybody, well, I mean, nobody wants their brain to work hard. That's just how your brain works. It doesn't want to work hard. But, you know, you see the value in being able to think clearly and thinking things through.
Yeah.
Over time as you get
older.
Some
of that, though, goes right along with what I see now that I'm not in the middle of educating kids, is that we're too impatient with reaching all the goals and all the steps and the standards that the world has put on us, where you're going, oh, my child doesn't know how to write yet. I'm failing. And so we don't give ourselves permission to say, let's just read a lot of good books until they want to write. There does come a point where you have to say, all right, you're going to have to do this. You're in high school now. You're going to have to accomplish some things.
Tanya, have you looked up that author?
No. Did you? Just do it.
Greta did.
Okay.
Greta just came down to tell me that if you look up that author, you will discover that she's an author of the first book of a first book. It's the first book of language.
Well, then I should have gone Greta straight knows to that Biblio, guys.
She went exactly. She took show notes and she's like, oh, let me go look that up in Biblio guides.
Oh my goodness, that's so funny. Oh, I love
but
that.
What a glowing endorsement for the first book series, if this is one of the authors, and what an endorsement for that book, because it's the same author as a first book author. So there's some confirmation bias there, but it's good.
Yes. Well, I'm just thrilled that this book waited for me on the shelf for so many weeks.
Yes.
Because I kept thinking, oh, I don't want to read a technical book about writing, and I don't know if we're there yet. And then I got it and I started reading it, and immediately my mind thought, I need to read this multiple times and apply this. I need to hear
the
essence.
You need to do a mom's book club on it.
I do. I started sharing it with a friend who's working with me on this school thing, and I said, we got to do something with this. We have to do a foundational thing where we help the children bring out their ideas and fall in love. And the author even says, no, not all of them are going to go on to be gifted writers or necessarily these, you know, but all
but
children.
If we can give all of them the gift of expression.
Yes, exactly. And how powerful. And then basically she ties that to the people who can express themselves and tell their stories are the people who are living with a lot of joy. Like, it does bring happiness to be able to take our experiences and share those experiences in interesting, unique, fun ways.
Yeah. So who knows? They might have a podcast someday.
I know, right?
Podcasts will be passé by then. But
Yes. Anyways, I feel like this is just a little gem. Then this is what I've been. And I keep – do you guys do this too? You read it and then you think, oh, I'm going to go tell somebody about it. And then it was such good information and you realize you can't tell it yet. This is why I also think narration is powerful. I can't narrate it yet because I'm still trying to consume and understand the ideas and let alone apply them or tell them. So I'm
– you did just narrate it to us though.
I have, but I was using the book and the quotes. I was like, okay, now then she said this and then she said this.
You know, so many times in the librarian groups that we're in, people are asking all these different things about how to be good librarians. And I just keep going back to read and review, read and review. All the other stuff is kind of irrelevant. Yeah, it's nice to know how to preserve a book. Yeah, it's nice to know how to like check it out to patrons. All those things are great. But the essence of being a librarian is reading and then being able to review those books, whether you have a blog or you just type them up on an, or write it out on an index card so that you can recommend the book to the person who needs it. So you can be a good book apothecary, right?
Yes.
But the more that we review what we're reading, whether it's to be shared publicly or just for ourselves, the more we journal through it and do these narrations with it, the more it becomes a part of us and we can better recommend it when it's needed, where it's needed, better we can
and really become a better reader. I just realized that it like ties back to what Tanya was saying earlier. I could totally see how that would make you a better reader.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I can do that.
Yay.
Anyway, so I highly recommend this book. And I didn't even look it up to see if it's rare or anything.
Obviously, it's out of print,
but it's probably on Internet Archive, I think.
Yes.
I would imagine that it is.
I have a fun book to share. So.
Yay! Sarah, tell us about your fun book. Let's end on a fun note.
Well, I actually listen to a lot of audiobooks because it's been a while since we've met.
Yeah.
But the one I wanted to share was called Nevermore, The Trials of Morgan Crow. Have you guys heard of this? It's a series. I've only listened to the first one so far. I think there's three or four, maybe another one coming out. So it's a newer series, fantasy, and it was so fun. Mm. It's been compared to Harry Potter. It's very captivating. It's completely other world. Morgan Crow is the main character, and you meet her when she's, I think, 11. And she's about to die because she's basically a cursed child who on Eventide, which is not just like, you know, Eventide in our world, but on this Eventide, she knows she's going to die. Oh. And she gets whisked away by this character called Jupiter North. So you know he's going to be a good character. And into this sort of other part of the world that she didn't even know existed. It's like another area outside of kind of the part that she's grown up in.
And he does this before Eventide?
It's like this free area. It was on Eve.
On the Eve.
So
okay.
On Eve. Yeah. She's she actually sees like these kind of dark characters that are coming to take her.
Okay. And so this is a rescue.
Get her out of there. Yeah. He rescues her.
Cool.
And then now she's going through these trials to enter into this wondrous society in this kind of free state that she's now a part of.
Oh.
And so it's just very, very fun. There's like some scene where she's going through a trial of like fear, and there's like some witches and like a kind of there. I mean, there's definitely some things I would caution parents that if they're concerned about that kind of stuff that they might want to pre-read it. Mm-hmm. But as an adult, like, I thought it was amazing.
Oh,
very captivating. If you just want like an escape novel, like it's not like, you know, great literature, but it's like, if you're kind of like at that point where you're having a really hard time getting back into reading and you just need something that's going to like take you away and capture you from the beginning and be exciting, like this would be a good one.
Or a good one, like if you've got some spring cleaning chores that you just don't want to do, or something like project that you just don't want to do, but a good audiobook will keep you company. I need a few like those at all times. Yeah. To bribe myself to do the thing I don't want to do.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And so did you say there's three books right now and a fourth one coming?
I think that's right.
Okay.
I definitely will read the next one. I don't want to give away too much of the story, but like she has some kind of ability that she doesn't know what it is, because in order to be a part of this wondrous society, you have to have some kind of special talent.
Okay.
And the person who sponsored her will not tell her what it is, and she doesn't know. And like the final trial is where she has to kind of like put it on display. So like right up to the end of the story, you don't know what her special talent is.
Is this the case and for everybody who enters the society? That it's
everybody else knows what they're good at.
Oh.
But she doesn't know what her
interesting
special ability is. That
and why won't they tell her?
Well, that's part of the story.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. It has to manifest itself to her. Okay, got it.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. How did you come across this series?
I don't even remember. I think I saw it online somewhere on Facebook, probably recommended somewhere. And then I looked it up and some people were saying it was even better than Harry Potter. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to give this a try.
I mean, I have so many teenage readers in the library. What age would you say? Because I think I might have readers for this. I might need to do this.
I think probably 12 and up, as long as you're okay with like, it wasn't particularly scary or anything, but there were like a few moments of like tension, like I said, where she's like dealing with some fear that's like part of a trial.
Sure. And, are there any
kind of dark characters that are after her?
Yeah. So are there mythical characters? Are there, you know, like in Chronicles of Prydain, are there the kind of undead?
Yeah, so one of the boys who's also in the trials, he's a dragon rider. There's all kinds of different characters. There's a cat who's a talking cat, and
classic fantasy stuff. Okay, gotcha. Yeah, cool. Yeah, yeah. Very cool. Yeah. Tanya, did you see that there's a Jennifer Nielsen that comes out next week?
No. What is it?
Uprising. I've got it on pre-order.
What's it about?
World War II again, I think.
Ooh, I'm going to go look.
It looks like Resistance, but similar to Resistance. That's what we speculate. We'll see.
Oh, because it says she also wants to aid the Jewish people held captive in the Warsaw Ghetto.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we're like, wait, it's another Warsaw Ghetto story?
It says based on a true story.
And this one, I think, is a non-Jew.
Yes. Yes.
So this could be a very interesting companion to Resistance.
How fun.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll be wanting to read that one also.
But that brings me to Sarah. Have you read Jennifer Nielsen's fantasy books? I think you said before you have. Is that right?
Yeah. You and I read the first one.
Oh,
together.
Yeah. The False Prince.
At the same time. Yeah. That's the only one I've read. I did listen to Words on Fire for the first time.
Oh.
It was my first historical fiction of hers that I listened to.
And?
I loved it. It was fantastic.
Yay! Yeah, okay. I was just wondering if you had done the Roman ones, because we have those.
No.
And very interesting. If you get to any of her other fantasy ones, let me know, because I'm not going to be able to preview all of them, and I'm curious about which patrons to give them to. So if you get tempted that way.
Okay. I'll put that on my list. Yeah. I listened to Words on Fire. I listened to Letters of a Woman Homesteader.
Oh, did you finally? Yeah. Okay. The thing that we were supposed to do for the last, together for the last year. Okay, good.
Yeah. I listened to A Single Shard. That was really good too.
I love that book.
Yeah, I need to get that.
I was reading that one, so I wanted to listen to it too. It's really good.
Have you ever read Little Pear?
I don't think so. Oh, wait. No, I think I have actually, a long time ago.
So I discovered Little Pear by accident. So I have a couple of patrons in my library who are, they were Chinese adoptions. So parents would like to cultivate a lot of Chinese culture in their home, a little bit like what you're doing, Sarah. Obviously not Chinese, but same kind of like dual culture. And so I reached out to Katie and I said, have you ever read Little Pear? She said, yes. I said, so have you read the others in the series? She's like, there's a series? And I got them. I have two of them. I need all of them. And because they loved the first book, and I thought, this is Carolyn Haywood, but set in China. And then sure enough, on the version that I got from Thrift or whatever, it's whichever publisher it was, who's recommended on the inner flap? B is for Betsy. I'm like, yep, okay, there we go.
I have quite a few of those, but I haven't read them yet.
Oh, so. Gosh, I haven't read them, but Tanya, I'm just waiting to like trip and fall into it. Mm. It's so cute. Look at the illustration.
Yes,
it's so adorable. Okay, when you're thrifting, if you see them, I need them all.
Okay, I'll watch for you.
Thank you.
I have one other book I want to share with you.
Yeah.
So this one is a longer picture book, I guess I would say. I think it's probably like, yeah, it's like 70 something pages, and it's called Lugal Banda. I just happened to find it at the library. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating because it's a folktale that is basically one of the oldest stories in the world. It's older than the Bible. It's older than Gilgamesh. The boy who's the main character of the story, I think, is actually potentially Gilgamesh's grandfather.
Wow.
And so it was written down in cuneiform and only found in like the last 150 years or something. And then it took them a long time to be able to translate it.
Sure.
And so it's like Uruk, like one of the Sumerian cities. Mm-hmm. And it's a story of a prince who like finds peace with one of the neighboring cities that are always warring. And it was just really fascinating to read a story that is that old.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, I think this is, potentially, I know there's like arguments about this, but I think this is like potentially the kind of environment that like Abraham lived in before he was taken away.
Sure.
You know, called by God and left. And so I think it's just kind of fascinating to read like one of their stories and like the kind of gods that they worshiped. And there's a lot of religion in it. But at the end of the day, it's like a story of how he made peace with his neighbors. So yeah, it was good and very fascinating, and I ended up getting a copy for myself just because I think that kind of history is interesting to have, to be able to share a story again that is just that old, right?
That old, and like you say, to contemplate people who are completely separated from God and yet were mm-hmm. created by God, and who share, and you know, they he desired for their existence. So to contemplate what their lives must have been like, it's so easy for us as Christians, modern comfortable Christians today, to just assume that this is easy to understand and that everybody has always lived this way. This is a very new way of thinking.
Yeah. And it's illustrated, so it's fun too.
Bonus. Very cool. Yep. How long is the story?
So like I said, I think it's like 70 something pages. Okay. And, you know, there's a decent amount of text on each page. It was written in 2006. Oh, and it was illustrated by Jane Ray. Do you guys know her? I love her illustrations.
No.
She illustrated The Story of Christmas and some others as well.
How would we look this up?
So the author is Kathy Henderson. She's the one that likes retelling the story. There's a great foreword. Yeah, that explains where it came from. Older than the Torah, the Bible, the Quran, older than Homer, Greek and Roman myths, older than the Epic of Gilgamesh. Yeah.
That must be where I heard that name, though. Yeah. Maybe was in Gilgamesh. I've heard that name.
Maybe. Kathy Henderson.
Lugal Banda. Yeah.
Oh, Lugal Banda. Yeah. 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 Because I think it says I can't remember if it was the father or grandfather. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting.
Sarah and Tanya, it has been fun to get back together again after, like, I don't know, weeks?
Six
I know.
Weeks.
We missed you. Thanks for being here.
We did.
It's fun to be back.
Ladies, this was, as always, a treat. And friends, we talked about a lot of really great stuff. And I don't know about you, but I'm even curious to go to the show notes and get links on some of these things. I want to go read the fantasy series that Sarah is talking about. And being from Wisconsin, I'm particularly curious about that Wisconsin author that Tanya was talking about. So, friends, we thank you for listening. We know your time is precious, and we thank you for sharing yours with us. If you are interested in finding out more about any of the books or resources that we talked about, head over to the show notes. And if you'd like to come and chat with us and tell us what you're reading this month, we'd love to know. You can come find us on social media. You can find us in the BiblioGuides online community. And also, fun fact, as we said, Greta found out that the author of the book that Tanya was talking about actually is the author of in a series that we really love and respect. And we've learned that because of BiblioGuides. So we encourage you, go check out BiblioGuides. And if you haven't done it yet, you know that there's a 7-day free trial. And this is not a commercial. I'm just thinking this is a good opportunity to make sure that you consider that and go try it out. So friends, thanks so much for being here. And until next time.